Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. Today, I am absolutely delighted to have not only a friend, but a returning guest to the show, Coco Newton. Coco is an extraordinary nutritionist who has really dedicated her life to understanding how what we consume metabolically, our food, the minerals our body needs, the substances our body needs, helps to repair, reverse, and change our body's health to be more robust and to help us to live fuller, healthier lives. So welcome to the show, Coco.
Thank you, Elaine, and thank you for having me back again.
Oh, I was just thinking about, gosh, how long ago it was we met. We, just to give you listening audience a little background, Coco and I were invited to participate in a NIH-funded research class at the University of Michigan, and we sat next to one another, and I felt like I was sitting next to somebody I knew for a long, long time. And gosh, that's got to be 20 years or more ago. So it's wonderful to have you on. So the thing that is so extraordinary, and I wanted to bring Coco back onto the show, was because of the work that she is doing principally and primarily with ALS, which is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And so, Coco, I'm going to let you do the explanation of what it is that you're doing and how this came about, please.
Certainly. Well, I just want to first give one little definition here of what that word means, that amyotrophic lateral sclerosis.
Please.
And yes, so when you break it down, A means no, myo refers to muscle, and trophic refers to nourishment. So it's no muscle nourishment.
Wow.
Yeah. So no muscle nourishment. And then lateral is just referring to the area in the spine where the nerve cells are and that then feed the muscles, which then feed our motor movement. So ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is a motor neuron disease. So just I wanted to clear people.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that clarity. I think that that's very powerful in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. And for the population, 90% of the cases are sporadic, which means that there's no family history, no genetics, no strong genetics. And so sporadic means we don't know why. It just happens. And then about 10% of people who have it running in their family, known as it's familial. So, and they're of those, some of them have a genetic cause that's specific, but anyway, you still treat it all the same.
Right.
So.
Okay. So how was it? First of all, your background is in nutrition. So could you give a little bit of understanding of what that means? What does it mean to be a nutritionist versus, let's say, a dietitian?
Well, that is a very loaded question.
Okay.
If you were to ask different dietitians or nutritionists, it can invite a lot of discourse.
Okay.
So I am both. I'm a nutritionist and I'm a dietitian. So I started out in dietetics, which really gave me mostly a very conventional view of health, based on the American Medical Association model of health, and so that basically says we have diseases, and with those diseases, we have diets for diseases and we have drugs for diseases. And then we have procedures such as surgeries and other things. So it did not teach me a holistic view whatsoever. And I knew that that was really missing. And I went on to study further in functional medicine and about 20 years ago, and then really dedicated my studies in that direction. So I am a registered dietitian. I'm also a certified nutrition specialist with a strong background in functional medicine. And so what functional medicine does is A practitioner has an architecture by which that they are reviewing and studying and looking for root causes that create illnesses. So illnesses don't just come to us. They're not just randomly attaching to us. They're always coming. There's always a root. And that root could be one or more of from emotional to toxins in our environment to exposures, while in utero, our diet, and our genetics, and on and on. So there are so many root causes, including infections and so forth that can bring on disease. And they can be infections you might have had, decades ago that are still working their damage. So the purpose of nutrition and functional medicine is to really get at the root, because nutrients and nutritional status, it isn't just about food, it's about metabolism. So if you think about it, all of our enzymes that create reactions in our bodies to fulfill physiological processes, they depend on minerals and vitamins and other nutrients to actually function. So that's my background. And I've worked with a lot of different conditions, the A to Z of most medical diagnoses. But 10 years ago, I received a referral for somebody who had ALS. And I was really caught off guard because I realized, wow, I have never seen anybody with ALS. I've never known anybody with it. And I don't even know somebody that has a loved one that I could think of with ALS. And ironically, my only exposure was through the book by Mitch Albom, Tuesdays with Maury. Yeah. The subject of his book had ALS, and that's how I first kind of came to know it. So I started this about 10 years ago, and then you all might remember the ice bucket challenge in 2014.
Explain that, please.
The ice bucket challenge. Do you remember when there were videos all over the world of people pouring buckets of ice on their heads?
Well, remember that we have a global audience, so I want you to explain.
Yeah, it's global. Yeah. So people were doing it a little different. In India, they were doing it with rice. In the U.S., with ice, and elsewhere. I can't tell you what they used, but they used what was available. And the whole idea was to raise awareness for ALS.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that's sort of when it hit the media and that's because it is a rare disease and rare as if it's, less than 200,000 people, in the United States. And we have, in the United States about, 2 out of 100,000, is the annual incidence. So
wow, very low.
It's rare, but it's also not uncommon at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So how was it that you started to take this under your wing, if I could?
So what happened was I was referred a patient, and I told the patient that I really didn't know anything about ALS. I had studied, a little bit about Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, so some other neurodegenerative conditions, but I had never had even a paragraph of a lecture on ALS. And so I told him that I don't think I should see you because I would be wasting your money and your time. And ALS in the standard textbook, it's a fatal diagnosis, and it's quickly fatal for most, 2 to 5 years, with very, very ugly deterioration. And so I was actually afraid to take on somebody that I thought, frankly, would die on me. And then I would have wasted their time and their money. So I put him off, and then he called a year later, or he did contact me a few times during the year, but he was still alive. And I thought, well, wait, maybe that's a sign. Maybe I should take him on. But I still was very reserved. So I told him I'll contact all my contacts, all my network, and I will find a practitioner for you. that really does know something, because I really want, you don't want to waste your time. And so I searched and searched, and I have a very vast network of practitioners that I interact with. And it turned out I couldn't find anybody, not a physician, not even a functional medicine neurologist, you know, not even a functional medicine based naturopath or anybody, and certainly no nutritionists or dietitians. So I thought, okay, you know, I see a void. I better try to help do something. So I told him, okay, I don't know how to treat ALS, but what if I just work with you and try to make your liver healthier so that you're able to handle what's coming into your body and toxins? And what if I make your gut healthier, you know, and get your digestion, your absorption, your microbiome balanced, at least check to see if you have parasites and fungus and bacteria and digestive disturbances. And then, you know, what if I try to get your cells healthier and look at your cellular energy status and so forth? What if I just try and make you a healthier person, you know, throughout your body? And if that helps the ALS, so much the better.
Absolutely.
But I certainly can't do any harm this way. And, you know, the first edict is to do no harm,
right,
in medicine. So that was my words to him. And he was totally on board, because, you know, we just did. And he's still alive 10 years later.
Wow. Yeah.
So, and actually when I met him, he had just come out of hospice. Somehow he had survived hospice. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me a lot of inspiration, encouragement, to think about this further. But I also felt, Elaine, that I'm never going to see another ALS patient. Nobody ends up in dietitians' offices or nutritionists' offices. They're typically being seen by their neurologist and kind of sequestered in that world of neurology. And because everyone looks at them as, you know, a kind of a time clock or, you know, towards death, people don't put a lot of effort into improving the gut, the liver, the rest of the body, the immune system, inflammation, and all the different parameters that play into ALS. So anyway, then he referred somebody to me. It was an ex-NFL player with ALS, and I was helpful for him. And then, you know, like once a year, I would get someone interested, someone heard I had done something with ALS. And then a few years ago, I published a chapter in a medical nutrition therapy textbook on ALS. And it turned out that I sort of by default became the expert. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know if there is one expert. There really isn't. It's trying to develop expertise in an area that has previously not been elucidated very well.
Well, I think, Coco, what is so interesting is what we forget, that our body itself is the expert.
Yes.
And if we give our body what it needs, and we go through the whatever diagnostics are required to determine what is maybe in too much of a quantity, not enough of a quantity, absence of a quantity of something, then I think that if you know, I think you're wise in just looking at, well, what do we know is not working?
Yeah.
Because health, we don't really understand health, nor do we really understand disease.
Well, that's exactly right. But it's with our understanding or our minimal understanding of how the body and ALS come to meet each other, and knowing that there can be decades preceding of downturns in the body's ability to cope with all the stressors that exist, it can be an enigma. I think what really, really inspired me was knowing, and your audience may be surprised, but it is reversible. Mm. And it is defined as an irreversible disease. Mm. You will not see anywhere in the medical literature that ALS is reversible. it is progressive. You will not see that you can stop ALS. You'll hardly ever see anything like that. You'll always see that it's progressive. So, but there's a physician at Duke University. He's head of the ALS clinic. His name is Dr. Richard Bedlack. And he has documented 50 reversals. Now, he hasn't caused those reversals. He's not taking responsibility for the fact that these reversals have happened, but he has studied the medical records. He's verified the diagnosis thoroughly. And what he's interested in doing is studying, well, why are these people reversing? Is there a common denominator? And there are many more reversals than just those. They just haven't all been documented, but it is rare. Reversals are very rare, but it's possible. So it tells us as clinicians and as even, you know, the potential patient or the ones that love them, the people who care for them, do not buy into a hopeless mindset. You know, the hopeless mindset would say there's no effective treatments and it's fatal. And the hopeful mindset says it could be slowed, it might be stopped, and it might be partially or completely reversible. Right. And I think, you know, people have to choose that. And that goes for other diseases too. But these reversals are amazing. I mean, what I mean by that, people dependent on a ventilator now able to breathe independently, or people that are feeding tube dependent, able to eat, and people that are wheelchair dependent, able to walk, and then also being able to perform, you know, personal care, like buttoning your shirt or eating your food or tying your shoes. So these things have reversed. And probably one of the most inspiring patients that I know, and I've met him personally, he was unable to talk, walk, speak or eat for, it was between 3 and 4 years, completely, utterly a prisoner in his own body. And now he's doing all of those.
So Coco, is there one thing in particular? I know you said that there's a whole panorama of things that could be possibly an initiating trigger or a combination of initiating triggers. But is there one thing that you have seen? You know, you and I both know that I'm an energy healer and I study what happens to the body mm-hmm. when with initiating with what we think. And I see, and we have seen all over the world, that medicine says that stress is a precursor to illness. So stress in that context is our emotional response to anything that happens. And the blocking or the anger or the resentment or whatever the emotion might be that is detrimental to the body because it creates an immediate chemical response.
So there are underlying, we're finding that there's often some very significant early childhood stress in a lot of patients. That's not everybody, because we can never just generalize.
Of course.
But definitely challenges and sometimes abuses that have happened that are deeply buried. But, you know, also all the way through, the mindset plays a role. But the mindset also has, you know, there's also underlying allergies. You know, early childhood exposure to toxins is so damaging to the brain. You know, prenatal exposure to toxins, you know, like I said, childhood traumas. The American diet is a stressor on the body.
Yes.
Because you have to detox all the bad chemicals in our diet, and also where you live. You know, what you're exposed to. There are clusters of ALS. And in Michigan, my home state, your home state, we are the highest. Us in Ohio are the highest per population in the whole United States.
Is that right?
Yep.
So are they making that correlation with industry?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Agricultural industry, manufacturing industry, mm. in most most commonly. But then, you know, during your life, have you had, you know, amalgams in your mouth, you know, silver fillings? Have you had physical traumas, occupational accidents or sports, contact sports is a big one, military, you know, especially the exposures, mold, and then infections, you know, like if you've had various infections throughout your life, and some of them you might have had years ago, but they're kind of dormant now, but that doesn't mean that they don't have an effect. And then of course the gut and the brain are intimately connected. So you have to really look at a person's gut health right away, because there's a gut brain highway called the vagus nerve, as well as the ability of toxins from the gut to actually be found in the brain.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so you really have to take care to evaluate that. And then things that keep it going, you know, are nutritional deficiencies, unclean air, just stress, emotional stress, depression, anxiety, you know, all of that can keep the process going. So I think it's all related. And of course, genetics.
Yes. And I think that, thank you for that explanation, because what I think, as you and I spoke the other day, that if something as quote unquote terminal as ALS, if that can be halted or mitigated or reversed, mm-hmm. what else might be? And if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is or was a part of the Hippocratic Oath that said, let food be your medicine. Mm-hmm. And so that the term of medicine has been so misguided in the allopathic model of medicine, mm-hmm. because it has been more commonly synonymous with drugs, mm-hmm. and artificial things, rather than understanding that the body uses what the body is made of, which is substances from the earth.
That's right. So when you come to really prioritizing nutrition, first, what you put into your body not only is good for its purpose, but it's also healing the dysfunctions in the body's metabolic processes. So really, like when I'm working with a patient, I'm doing a very thorough nutrition analysis, you know, dietary analysis, nutritional analysis, metabolic analysis, stool analysis, sometimes hormonal analysis, and on, toxin analysis, knowing what kind of heavy metals or environmental toxins are in the body. And so you start to get a picture of where, and of course, infections, but you start to get a picture of where you need to prioritize your focus. And so when it comes to diet, you know, you've got to support the feeding requirements, because one of the problems with ALS is people hyper metabolize. So they burn calories at a much higher rate than the average person. Mm. And they're actually burning calories, even though they might not be moving at all, they're burning calories almost like an athlete, like a performance athlete.
Now, is that because their body, their nervous system is so hyperactive?
It is. That's part of it. So a lot of people with ALS will have fasciculation. So you'll see their nerves twitching. You'll see it in the arms and the legs and so forth. And that obviously consumes a lot of energy. But also they don't metabolize glucose properly. So their body is unable to make energy out of glucose, where you and I can. And so there's a lot of wasteful energy that happens. And so weight loss is a cardinal, that's probably the cardinal sign of deterioration, is weight loss. Everybody from the moment of diagnosis is afraid of losing weight, trying to maintain weight or gain weight. So that is very important. But you can't support that with empty calories. And right now in the conventional world, they're still giving people Ensure And, you know, Ensure, if you're familiar with that, with the canned supplemental.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. There's many, many forms of them. And so they're constantly taking in really toxic, it's not even food, you know, it's kind of a chemical concoction. Mm-hmm. So you have to use organic foods. I bet that's insisted upon. And the foods have to be anti-inflammatory. So that is, you know, going to include a lot of things that we really love. You know, some of those foods could be like, you know, deeply colored fruits and vegetables. You know, think of the rainbow. Think of the colors of, you know, red, orange, yellow. Yes. You know, and so forth, green, blue, violet. And so deeply colored fruits and vegetables have phytochemicals in them, that are neuroprotective. So they can protect nerve cells, neuronal cells. They can reduce all that's what's called oxidation and reduce inflammation. And they can actually make the mitochondria of the cell, which is the powerhouse of the cell that makes the ATP that we run on. That's the energy we run on. And it can increase the number of those mitochondria and the function of the mitochondria. And so it also allows the body to actually function better. And so that's so important. And the same with herbs. A lot of different herbs are very effective, like turmeric and ginger, cilantro, ashwagandha, basil, oregano, things that we often are very familiar with that are neuroprotective.
Yes. Well, you know, as we're talking, I really want to introduce you to some indigenous elders that I know that are very, very aware of plant medicine. Mm. And I think that, you know, your joint knowledge might be very powerful. But that comes to, you know, again, I believe I shared with you that, you know, well, I know that, you know, one of my brothers, my late brothers, was indeed a tube feeding patient because he had advanced throat cancer. And so I hated every time I had to put that damn Jevity into his bag.
Yes.
And you tried to help me get something that was more nutritionally sound. I can't remember the name of it, but unfortunately he did succumb to it. But, you know, it taught me an awful lot because he was a sweet and extraordinary human being. But his body was already dumped with chemicals because of all of the disease process, and then the chemo and the radiation and the damage, and then put more toxic chemicals of supposed nutrition into the body, and it was a recipe for disaster.
Yes, and this is what they're still doing.
Yes, I know. It's actually almost.
This goes back to when, you know, I was in an undergraduate. We were still using a lot of the same products or variations of the same products. Mm-hmm. And they make no medical sense whatsoever. It's a contract with a company for a formulary, and that's what drives it. It's money.
Right.
So I probably told you then about Liquid Hope.
That's what it was. Yes. Yes.
Yes. And Liquid Hope, that came out, that is a, it could be an oral or a tube feeding formula. And that came out of a woman who developed it, whose father had a stroke and couldn't eat. And she just couldn't bear feeding him the commercial formulas. Now there are also people who make these formulas at home. You know, they make their own whole foods formulas, and that's great. And there's some wonderful recipes for that, but not everybody has time nor the staff or caregiving ability to keep that up on a regular basis. But
Go ahead, please.
I'm just thinking that, you know, there's so much that can be done. And here we have a very rare disease that seems actually now pretty common to me, and that we have to change our way of looking at disease, and we cannot buy into a terminal diagnosis. I think that's one thing, because most of my, all my patients have been told they're going to die.
Interestingly, earlier in our conversation, you said that someone survived hospice.
Yeah.
And, but the reality is that the criteria for hospice is that it, they have to be able to substantiate a decline within a 6 month period of time. That's the criteria. So they're expecting, and they expect a decline. They don't expect an improvement, mm-hmm. which is counterintuitive to the notion of health care.
Yeah.
It's more disease care, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that we have to shy away from death, because that is a part of our existence. It is a completion of a life. But when we, our focus is on maintaining a disease instead of maintaining health, then our focus is a little bit out of balance, more than a little bit.
Well, hospice, yeah, basically hospice is translated into I'm going to help you die.
Yes.
With some dignity.
Yes.
And so my patient, he prayed the whole time he was in hospice. Mm-hmm. He obviously couldn't do anything different, right? He was in hospice.
Right.
And he didn't die, and he didn't deteriorate fast enough to keep him in hospice.
And I will say, I used to work in hospice, and it's a beautiful, you know, we all need to have that dignity when it is our time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very important thing, but it's not, it never should be a sterile process. It's life.
It's life. Yes.
So let me ask you, Coco, and again, my guest is Coco Newton, and she is doing extraordinary work with helping individuals who have ALS, either through, you know, looking at all combinations of what is happening to them metabolically, physically, mentally. How can it at least stop its progression or minimize its side effects, and at best to reverse it? So can you tell me, Coco, what has been the conversation you have had with people who in the past thought that this was absolutely impossible? In other words, physicians.
Yes. Well, by some people receive this information positively. I would say most physicians receive this information with total skepticism. So that you must be wrong about the diagnosis, or it was something else. It wasn't ALS, or this. And sometimes they're not even really curious. Mm. So it can be discounted. But I do have some doctors, and they're all in the more open-minded, integrative field, who still at first don't believe it because it's so fatal. But are really open to finding out, well, how could this be, you know? And what I do is I direct them to the chapter I wrote for this textbook, and that was published in 2020, and on ALS and the use of integrative and functional medical nutrition therapy. And it is highly referenced. I've got like over 400, close to 450 scientific citations in this chapter. And the reason I wrote it so heavily laden with science and citations is that I want it to be taken seriously. You know, I don't want this to be looked at as someone who thinks she has a few bright ideas. So much of the science is in the literature. I lost you.
Oh, no.
Oh, there you are. Okay. So much of the science is in the literature. So much of the science is accessible, but it's been done in a very, very kind of disparate way and never put together for developing a clinical approach. And so that's what I really aim to do with this chapter, is bring it all together and show physicians things that are in the literature, but not necessarily in your face, where you can read about it and apply it clinically. And so it's kind of undeniable that the science is there, that this can happen, but it's not been brought together clinically.
Well, I think that what is so interesting, Coco, is the notion of science is, in my mind and in the many people that I've spoken to who have a great lineage of information, mm-hmm. is science is the study of what is. It is not the ownership of information. It is in its best, the willingness to observe what life is doing. And life is and always will be surprising us. So to say that something is impossible mm-hmm. is arrogant at best mm-hmm. and foolish at the worst. And, you know, we did not create science. Science is the study of what is already in existence. And we are in existence. The parts that work, that make life possible, have been here long before we have been here.
And it always changes.
It always changes because our environment is changing.
Right. So it's okay if the science turns on its own head
exactly.
because it comes out with more information. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if science didn't change, then it would be a very static subject.
That's right.
Okay, so we are observers, and we can't just discard our observations that don't fit into our mindsets and our beliefs.
Right.
So that's a big part of this. And so for the patients, I only work with patients that believe they can heal. So I don't try to bring anybody into my practice to talk them into, well, you really can do this. I know you can, you know.
Right.
No, I'm attracting the people and the people that call me and just want to work are people that are saying, I do not believe I have to die.
Right.
I realize it's a possibility, and I realize very clearly that's, you know, more likely than not, but I'm going to be in that not category.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to fight this with everything I have, or I'm going to address this or meet the challenge of this or ride the roller coaster of this or whatever terminology you want to use, but they're going to address it.
Right. Another thing in our conversation we had the other day was, and I try to correct people when they say, well, I'm going to fight this. And that's a language that is used so often in commercial advertising and in medicine, because they want to go to battle. They want to be the victor. And the reality is, if the battle is happening within a singular body, then someone must lose. And that loss has got to be yourself. So I think that we have to even change our language and how we're helping our body help itself. We're giving it what it needs. And so I think that what's so beautiful and why I wanted you to have this conversation here on this international platform is because we have to rethink everything about what we see in our lifetime. This is not the only experience of humanity, of our industrial age, of our mechanization, of our chemicals. There is and will continue to be far more life-sustaining and supporting ways of doing things that have nothing to do with money, have nothing to do with status, and everything to do with life.
Well, that is so true. And that's why I want your listeners to know about a website. It's called healingals.org. And I don't know if maybe you can share that with them later or how you...
Yes, absolutely.
But this is exactly... The purpose of this website, it is bringing ALS, people with ALS, we call them PALS, P-A-L-S, PALS, from around the world into a community. So we maybe 40 different countries or so represented. And we discuss healing and on in meetings, but also the website is full of amazing resources. And a lot of it has to do with how you set your mind, because you can't expect to heal while you're living in fear or negativity or doubt.
That's right.
You can't expect to heal. But you sometimes need to work through that fear, negativity, and doubt. You know, it doesn't just happen overnight. You don't just get a diagnosis like this and skip that grieving period.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you had mentioned also that you had worked in the past with people with Parkinson's, with multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. And the word sclerosis is in both of these diseases, multiple sclerosis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Mm-hmm. So what does the term sclerosis mean?
So sclerosis is when you have hardening. Okay. So for ALS, it's referring to the atrophy. Mm-hmm. And the scarring of the voluntary muscles that mm-hmm. then cause paralysis.
Okay. And versus multiple sclerosis?
That's a completely different, I mean, it's a neurodegenerative disease.
Where the myelin sheath is dissolved.
Right. Right. Right.
So again, we might need to find a way to help the body have the ingredients or whatever you want to call it to perhaps repair that damaged myelin sheath.
Yeah, and myelin gets damaged in ALS too. It's just not, it's more of a secondary damage rather than a primary, but definitely the myelin is affected. So that's why for some of these diseases, you can cross over a lot of information and apply them, you know, to ALS, to multiple sclerosis, to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so forth. But then there are distinct kind of metabolic pathways that these diseases are in and that make them uniquely their own. Mm-hmm. And so then you have to really personalize it. But in terms of protecting the brain, in terms of helping the brain regenerate, in terms of, decreasing toxins, improving gut health and so forth in the body, these things are universal.
Right.
You want to be doing that anyway. You want to be doing that long before you have a diagnosis of anything.
Right.
And this.
You would think that, you know, we all are predisposed at some point in our life to some kind of disease process. But if it's all of these puzzle pieces, for lack of a better way to say it, are put in place, we might not have those experiences. Although they might be a likelihood, they could be mitigated in some way. Mm-hmm. So How are people getting in touch with you, and what is the best way for people to get in touch with you, Coco?
Well, my website, coconewton.com, is the best way to get in touch with me.
Okay. Yeah. And are you open to conversations with individuals?
So what I do, okay, my patient load is, and you can go to ALS there on my website, the far left says ALS.
Okay.
And then you can also contact me. I'm not taking on more patients right now because it's a very labor intensive and I'm at my max. But what I do for people that are diagnosed, for example, that I can't take on as my own patients, I offer half hour free consults.
Hmm.
So, for example, after we hang up today, I have a consult with a woman and her sister who has ALS in Israel, you know, and all I'm doing there is just trying to get people directed towards the right resources to help them.
So are there people that you're helping to train or helping to, or maybe just by virtue of what you're doing, people are looking elsewhere to help to support the body?
Right. So what I try to do in the U.S. and in a few countries in Europe, I've tried to link people up with practitioners that would be the most likely to help them.
Hmm.
So I do some due diligence on who's in your area, what's your zip code, how far are you willing to travel, and so forth, to try to link people with practitioners. Because I feel like right now, I just say, read my chapter, give your practitioner my chapter. If they're interested in helping you, they'll read the chapter and then they'll do their own research and they'll do their own work and they'll draw upon their own unique skills to help you. Because what you need as a patient, I don't care what diagnosis you have, especially if it's that, you know, quote, terminal sounding, you need a partner.
Yes.
You need someone who's willing to work with you.
Yes.
And what happens is a lot of people end up in offices, and the physicians, the clinicians are like, I don't know what to do with this. I'm not, you know, they're not really tuning in with the patient's desire to live. And so, yeah, that's what has to happen.
Well, I think that what you're saying is so true, because the allopathic model of medicine is so numbers driven. And I talk to many people in medicine that are so disheartened, because this is not why they went to medical school or to nursing school, to just, you know, look at a computer screen all day. They're naturally caregiving people. They want to learn. They're curious. They're compassionate. And I think that we have to change what we define as medicine.
Right now for in training, about 12% of the time average is spent in patient contact, touching the patient, talking to the patient, asking them questions, checking them. Most of the time is on the computer.
Yes.
Medical education has really shifted in that direction too. So it's a kind of a hands-off way of doing medicine, because you can just keep referring to your computer screen. Yeah. And, you know, you can overlook the patient instead of looking at the patient.
Right.
And it's easy. It's easier because you're not as intimate. And so the whole physical exam, patients need to be touched. They need to know that someone is like listening and touching and thinking, you know, there's something to this. There's something very important. And the physical exam is kind of going by the wayside to quite an extent, where everything now is numbers driven, like you said.
Right. And we have to remember that our body is designed for perception. Mm-hmm. Our sensory perceptions tell us so much that words cannot convey, that numbers cannot convey. You know, our ability to hear, see, taste, smell, touch. You know, we, as you and I know that you're a mother, you know, by touching your child's skin, what, you don't need to look at a thermometer to see someone has a fever. You mm-hmm. touch them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much that we are desensitizing ourselves to. And we need to not do that.
Right. And when you're working with someone with ALS who wants to live, you can't do that. You have to be very sensitive to that, them. And even on a screen, like I work with people internationally, mm-hmm. I know I can't touch the person, but I ask them so many questions, and their caregivers are always there, that I feel like I'm in the room with them as best as possible. It does sure. not feel hands off, even though technically it is.
But, and I think that one of the challenges that we have been trained, knowingly or unknowingly, to disavow what we feel. So many times when I'm working with an individual doing healing, I ask them what they feel and they tell me what they think. Mm-hmm. And I have to redirect them, no, what is the tactile sensation? Mm-hmm. What is the physiological sensation you notice? Because people are terrified of being wrong or sounding like they're complaining if they give too much information. So we have to let that space be open for true and genuine conversation that's mutual.
That's right. Yeah. You know, I think with ALS, because people are suffering so physically so hard, they can't breathe, you know, they can't take a breath, they can't swallow. It depends upon where the ALS shows up first. Is it in the periphery? Is it in the feet or the hands, or is it in the voice, you know, and the swallowing? Because it can show up first in different places. There's such a, it's like someone coming and just punching you in the stomach and saying, you know, you can't function like you used to. And it's a very scary thing not to be able to breathe.
Right.
Very, very scary to lose weight and not be able to eat, or choking on your food, and all of this that is so common with ALS. And so there's a very, strong will and a strong vision that a person has to have to see that this can be reversed, mm-hmm. or it's possible to be reversed. And So they have to really communicate. They're communicating about their body with me by telling me all the intricacies of what they're experiencing. Mm. You know, every bowel movement and what's there, you know, what it looks like, what it feels like. I feel like I'm getting, they're very, 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 I guess to your point, they're getting very expressive with being able to respond to that. Like, what do you feel? I get those feelings from them. Mm-hmm. You know, they bring into their body.
Yeah. When people are accustomed to being outdoors, they can look at an animal's excrement and know what animal it is. Yes. You know, so there's information that, you know, it's not meant to be, ooh, this is gross. This is life. Mm-hmm. This is life. So I want to thank you for all that you've done, Coco. I mean, you're just extraordinary in that you're so genuinely curious and caring. And I think that, I believe that 90% of people in medicine are as well, but they just have followed a path that they themselves realize might be a dead end. And so I think that we have to learn how to see ourselves as one amazing unit, not just a nerve ending or a heart. You know, we're all parts working together with life.
Right. Right. Thank you, Elaine.
Well, we're not quite done yet. We've got a few more minutes.
So. Oh, okay. I thought you were...
No, I just wanted to say that because I think it's important. So what do you feel now that you know, you mentioned earlier your initial apprehension that you didn't know anything about this. And now you know more than you did before. And I hope that that opens you to so many other things, because I would imagine that by certain protocols that you're delving into, you may be reversing many things that the person possibly didn't even know they had.
Well, right now, maybe, but I'm not seeing those patients. I'm seeing the people who are really, really, really sick. So I would say in my own lifestyle and my family's, you know, what I preach is exactly what I would want for a lot of my patients.
Right.
You know, I eat the way I teach.
So what in the last 5 minutes, what do you think would be the most basic things that humans can begin to do, that people can begin to do to really start to make a change, to just begin to feel better?
Well, I do feel connection with nature is really important, and connection with where food comes from.
Yes.
Because there's no appreciation otherwise in understanding that this food is you. Food is medicine. Yes. And it goes back to the Hippocratic Hippocrates, who said, let food be thy medicine and thy medicine thy food. So I feel that. I feel, I mean, love is probably the most powerful medicine. Mm-hmm. And love for life, love for higher power, love for each other, love for self. And I feel like those are just two of the most important ingredients, or three: nature, food, and love.
Yes. And when we understand, a wise medicine person said to me once that, you know, many people think they have a life. No, you don't have a life. You are life being lived. And you cannot have a singular life, because life is intimately connected to everything in existence. The water that we consume has been here for tens of millions of years. The air that we breathe, that knows us better than we know ourselves, has been recirculated around the planet 1,000 times over in our own lifetimes, and has traveled around the planet. And we all truly are connected. And when we remember those building blocks, that how long it took for the earth to prepare for humans to be here. in and of itself should stop us in our tracks.
You remember Viktor Frankl?
Yes.
Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
One of his quotes is just what you just said really kind of fits into one of his quotes and about life. And that is, and I don't have the quote exactly, but, you know, we're always asking, well, what's the meaning of my life? When am I going to find what my meaning is? And his answer is you give life meaning. You don't go searching around for the meaning of your life. You give it meaning. And I would say for me, I've always wanted to help, but I didn't know how I should help or where I should help or who I should help. And in nutrition, in my field of nutrition, I've just always wanted to help people heal. And so these patients give my life meaning because I'm following my purpose, and that is to give meaning to life. So if I can give meaning to life for someone else, and at the same time it gives so much meaning to me, it's synonymous.
Yes. So, and when we realize that life already means something, that our matter matters.
Right. And that we have to also give our life meaning. We can't passively just say, oh, what's the meaning of, no, what means something to you? And then put your energy behind it.
Right.
And then your life has meaning.
Right. Well, our time is now up, Coco. So I want to thank you again. My guest has been Coco Newton, swiftly becoming a world-renowned neurologist.
Not neurologist,
nutritionist, excuse me.
Nutritionist.
Who's working with people with ALS. And I want to thank you for all that you do and all that you're about to do and all the lives that you're opening in wonderful ways. Thank you so much, Coco.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for hosting me and for all that you do for your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You go out and make today a good day. It is up to you. As Coco said, make your life have meaning.